is our presenter, Don Cloverly. Today's session number is 99-3, and it's titled Romeo and Ethel, the Pirate's Daughter. Let's listen in on Don.
This session. To those of you who have been in previous sessions, welcome back. To those of you that this is your first session, welcome. My name is Don Cloverly. This is the third session in a series of five. The series title is Geology and the Earth, where the roots of the Tree of Life begin. Today's session is titled Romeo and Ethel, the Pirate's Daughter. Now, those of you who've seen Shakespeare in Love, there's a chance this will make sense. If you haven't, yeah, there's no chance. The point was that at the start of the movie, I don't think I'm really blowing anything for those of you that haven't seen it, Will Shakespeare, the poem, the play that he's writing, he's calling Romeo and Ethel the Pirate's Daughter. And that doesn't really sound very good, so after a little bit of work, it turns out to be Romeo and Juliet. It turns out to be a great play, and everybody's happy. The sort of general thrust of tonight's talk is about an idea that was originally proposed by a German named Alfred Wegener, and he called it continental drift, and proposed this back in about 1912, and the reaction was mixed at best. A few people liked it, a lot of people thought he was nuts, and 1912 to say 1962, 51, 52 years later, it turns out to be the central theory of the science of geology. So the analogy is between Will Shakespeare and Alfred Wegener. Things didn't go so well at the start and then turned out good in the end. And that plus to get everybody to laugh and come down to the session. Before we get into that, there are a few things, a few general characteristics of the Earth that I would like to pass along. And for the folks who were in here yesterday, that'll be a part of it will be review and part of it will be new. And to those of you that haven't been here before, these are just some, I was thinking about it this morning saying this is my opening argument of the case I'm trying, so I'm just laying these things out here and then I'll pick them up through the talk as we need them. First off, since I didn't really think about it very much until preparing for this, does anybody know how big the Earth is? I didn't really know very precisely. The Earth is about 25,000 miles in circumference. For people who prefer the metric system, that's about 40,000 kilometers. So if you travel from the East Coast to the West Coast, you've gone a little bit more than 10% of the way around the world. If you run 1,000 marathons, you've pretty much gone around the world. Geometry says then that if the radius is 25,000, or the circumference is about 25,000 miles, the radius should be about 4,000. So from Hull Village to the center of the Earth is about 4,1120 or something. What's the elevation? That's about 6,500 kilometers. One of the things we finished with yesterday is that the Earth is layered. It's not homogeneous from Holden Village to the center of the Earth. At the center of the Earth, we presume, is solid iron, or an iron-nickel compound. The next layer outside, that's called the core, or the inner core. The next layer outside that is called the outer core. We believe that's liquid iron, or that liquid iron-nickel compound. The only difference being that there is so much pressure on the center of the Earth that even though it's hot enough for that iron to be melted, it's solid just because there's so much weight on top of it. Next out is a layer called the mantle. Sort of at the top of the mantle is a layer called the asthenosphere, Greek or Latin for lacking strength. Now we've kind of made it onto our picture here. And the key thing to think about this asthenosphere is while it's on the short term solid, on the long term it acts like a plastic. You go, wait a minute, how does that happen? Well, there are other substances that are like that. One of those happens to be glass. Mm-hmm. That if you go up to a window and hit it with a hammer, it will break. But if you go, and this has been reported to me, I don't know this for certain, but if you go to the churches, like in England or in Europe, the windows are thicker at the bottom than they are at the top, because over the 400 years they've been in place, that glass has started to flow. So on the short term, like however long it takes for a hammer to hit a window, it's solid. In the long term, it's a fluid. It's a highly viscous fluid. Now, what does viscosity mean? That means that it's the resistance to flow. If you have a glass of water on the table and you knock it over, unless you have really quick reflexes, all the water will come out. If you have a glass that's half full of maple syrup, you can knock it over and reach over and pick it up and nothing will come out. If you have something in there like molasses, you can knock it over, go up and have coffee break, have a meeting, come back, and then pick it up and nothing has leaked out. So it's that thickness of the stuff. The other thing about that is viscosity is temperature dependent. So hot maple syrup flows faster than cold maple syrup. You've got to get back faster or else the stuff will come out of the glass. On top of the asthenosphere is the lithosphere, which is rigid under all conditions, and on top of that is crust. And we have identified two separate kinds of crust, continental crust and oceanic crust. I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. Second thing, that's the structure of the Earth. It's a layered system. The second thing is the Earth is hot at the center and relatively cool at the surface. Temperature at the center is about 4,000 degrees centigrade. That's 7,250 degrees Fahrenheit. And at the surface, I guessed it was about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Close enough, 5 or 10 degrees either way doesn't matter, which is 15 degrees centigrade. Now, if you have something that's hot in one spot and cold in another spot, the heat goes from the hot place to the cold place. It's a basic law of physics, one of Newton's laws of Coulomb's, I think. Is that right?
Sounds good.
Okay. And when material is solid, that heat is transferred by conduction, which means one little hot molecule heats up the next little hot molecule, heats up the next little hot molecule, and on or from the center to the out. Where once things become liquid, the process of convection takes place. And luckily my high-tech convection indicator has just now started to do this. I don't know if anybody else owns a lava lamp, but for about the first hour and a half it sits there and doesn't do anything. I came down here like at 4 o'clock to plug this thing in, and 5 minutes ago this wasn't happening, so it's working out perfectly. An absolutely perfect example of the idea of convection. A heat source at the bottom, in this case a light bulb, in the case of the Earth, the core. Material that gets heated becomes less dense because the molecules get excited and expand a little bit, and now they're more widely spaced than their neighbors, therefore they're lighter and they start to rise. This material comes up towards the surface where it is cooler. It cools and it sinks back down. The only difference between this and what geophysicists and geologists expect happen in the Earth is that inside the Earth, it would, if we had a big flat one of these things, kind of like a fishbowl, you'd see that those would come up and form like circuits or conveyor belts. They're known as convection currents. So rather than it being sort of a single unit thing here, there would be convection cells set up in the Earth's crust, and that's what we think happens. The point of that is to dissipate heat away from the Earth's core and towards the surface. Okay. That's the second thing. First thing is the Earth's layer. The second thing is it's hot at the center, cool at the surface. Third thing is the Earth has a magnetic field. I'll talk more about that later, but just to get things set up, we think that the reason that the Earth has a magnetic field is it has something to do with currents or flow in that liquid part of the core. The basic ideas of magnetics are fairly well worked out. How it applies in this specific case is not well understood at all. Just another one of the many things I've talked about so far this week that doesn't have a good explanation. The last thing is the Earth is tremendously old. We talked yesterday, shared an analogy where if the 6,000 years, what I claim to be recorded human history, from about 4,000 years BC to 2080, like next January, if that 6,000 years of recorded human time is the width of a sheet of paper, then the age of the Earth is a stack of paper 250 feet high. And how to see that here in the village is from the front door here when you walk out to the hike house sign is 250 feet. So go somewhere where you can see that distance and imagine a stack of paper and then go, this is how much we are, that's how much the Earth is. So today and more into tomorrow, when you think about this idea of plate tectonics and say, wait a minute, plates, you say plates move at the rate about that a fingernail grows. How can you get continents scooting around like pinballs? There's time. There's plenty of time. Okay, so those are the four things. The Earth's layered, it's really old, conducts heat, it's got a magnetic field. It's just like a lava pan. Okay. We're going to talk about plate tectonics. I would just like to introduce it very briefly, and then we'll come back to it at the end of tonight and all of tomorrow. So I tried to write a three-sentence summary of plate tectonics. The outer surface of the Earth is made up of 8 large and 10 smaller rigid pieces called tectonic plates, and those are shown on that first figure that you have. These plates move in relation to each other on a layer of rock, which while appearing rigid, exhibits characteristics of plastic flow over long periods of time. That's the asthenosphere. The plates are driven by convection currents in the mantle, the lava lamp. These convection currents form as a way to transmit heat away from the core. That's it. That's the story. The rest of it is just a lot of details that you help get you a doctoral somewhere. If you like, you won't do very well on the quiz, but the point of, we've talked, those folks who have been here for the other two sessions, we talked about models and theories and what the point of that is. And the point of a model or the point of a theory is to explain observed phenomena. How can the model that we come up with has to match up with the things that we see. And then once we have some idea about that, we use it to predict what we might see and help us plan future things. The plate tectonic theory is this unifying, keeps talking about it being this comprehensive unifying theory of the science of geology, so it better explain a lot of things. What does it explain? It explains the location of earthquakes, where we find them on the globe, and how deep they seem to be. It describes where we find volcanoes, both on continents and in what are called volcanic arcs, offshore areas like Japan. It helps describe the location of mountain ranges. One of the kind of big things about geology is the mountain ranges. And it helps describe or help us figure out how and where certain rock types are distributed and the creatures that live on or used to live on and are now buried in those rocks. So that's the point of the model, and it seems to be working fairly well over the last 20 years, but I would like to step back now and talk about the old days before plate tectonics was originally proposed. So to do that, the first talking anybody ever did about plate tectonics was in 1912. So let's step back to the geology of the day before 1912. Modern geology started in about 1788 when James Hutton went to Sicker Point in Scotland and scratched his head and said, this doesn't look the way it's been described. There's something different here. Geology went through a bunch of growth. By 1912, one of the things that hadn't been answered was, what was the origin of mountain ranges? Now you'd think, with it as being a big part of geology as it, you know, seems to the layperson, you'd think that we'd have made some progress on that, but geologists move fairly slow. There was really no good answer that made sense to people and everybody agreed on. This was a bigger problem in Europe than it seemed to be in Britain, probably because there are more mountains in Europe than there are in Britain. Geology is kind of a parochial thing that probably doesn't happen for Lutherans or anything, but it's true in geology, where you kind of worry about the geology of your neighborhood and something else is going on someplace else. If you get time to get around to it and study it, that's great, and if not, you keep taking care of your own backyard. The main idea of what was happening with the Earth was that the Earth had one day been molten and was cooling and was contracting. The main proponent of this was Kelvin, William Thomson Kelvin, also known as Lord Kelvin. Not only the preeminent scientist of his day, but pretty much the only scientist of his day. In looking at my scientific dictionary to find other names in that same time, the only one that comes up is the guy named Mendeleev, who was the creator of the periodic table for chemistry. But in the other sciences, there, you know, wasn't anybody else. So with him being really smart and able to out logic everybody, it's pretty much whatever he said went, until there was a really massive weight of counterbalancing evidence. So the point was, he thought, and therefore everybody else thought, that the Earth had one day been molten and was cooling. And contracting is that habit. So that's sort of the long-standing idea. Other bits and pieces I'll throw in here just to sort of give you an idea of where things were at. They did a study and found out that the Himalayan mountains seem to exert less gravity than they should. I'll explain that. One of the techniques that geologists use to do sort of bigger scale mapping or investigations further into the below the surface are called geophysical techniques. One of those is gravitational techniques. Mass, one of the properties of mass is that it generates, it has a gravitational attraction to any other mass. In work I did in Arizona, we were trying to figure out, we had an area where we were trying to drill and find faults because that's where we thought the water was. And the surface was covered, but we thought at depth that there was a block that had sort of been dropped down. We did a geophysical a gravity survey and found an area where they're looking down as a map view right now, and this area had really high gravity, and this area had really high gravity, and this area had low gravity. The assumption that we made was, since the gravity was low, the mass was low, and this area was filled in with materials that had been shed off these mountains. The mountains were denser material, so high gravity, dense material, low gravity, low density material. It was these lines that were the faults, that this had dropped down a block here that the stuff then fell into. And so what we wanted to do was try and find places where we could drill along that line and try to intersect that fault. So that's the idea behind gravity surveys. They did one of those for the Himalayas and found that the Himalayas didn't generate as much gravity as they thought, you know, as they expected. And so the conclusion they came to was, here's the mountains, and they were sitting on some kind of denser crust. The only conclusion that they could come to was that really what was happening was, here were the mountains, and there was an additional mount sunk down sort of into this stuff that was thought to be rigid and hard and dense. And to me, this is simply the iceberg principle. In geology, we call it isostasy. Everybody else should call it the iceberg principle. When an iceberg calves off and goes into the water and goes someplace warm, and the top part melts off, it doesn't melt down, and now you've got a submerged iceberg, right? The top part melts off, and the iceberg changes in buoyancy due to that removal of weight above, and it sort of bobs up and down depending on, and if it goes someplace colder and more snow is added to it, it sinks back down. So it floats and it bobs back up and down based on if you take material off, you're not gonna heat it down to the water line, and now you've got something that you can't see, the iceberg will respond to that. It's the same idea that if this material is less dense than the material it's sort of sitting in, it'll bob up and down, depending on whether, if you erode material off the top and this becomes lighter, the mountains will rise up a little bit. The change from this thing that they saw in the field to this hypothesis was by a geologist by the name of G.B. Airy, and he called it isostasy, and it was one of the big ideas of 1850, 1860, something like that. The American geologist J.D. Dana was the first person to hypothesize this idea that there might be two different kinds of crust. And he had a picture in his head that he put on paper and then published, and everybody liked pretty well, where sort of at the edge, and with him being an American, this applies really well to America, and the study of geology there. And so here was his oceanic crust, and went into the continental crust, which was a little bit higher so that we could live on it. And I don't know that he spoke anything about what happened below, but at these areas where things connected, he felt there was a zone of weakness there. And with erosion off of the highlands, the stuff would sort of settle in here and you would get a down warp and a bowing of this area, and it would fill in with material and continue to sink, and at some point get hot enough to melt or get really weak, and then these lateral forces, as the planet continued to cool, if you're trying to fit the same amount of crust around a ball that's shrinking, and it kind of has to stick to what's below it, and so this, it starts pushing on each other. I don't know if that's a real technical term, but this would, and so there would be force kind of this way, and now you'd mash stuff together. And this seems to be a very good model for the Appalachian Mountains. And with this being 1873 and Dana being in America, my guess is he studied somewhere on the East Coast. So this was what was in his backyard. He sees another big mountain range out on the West Coast called the Sierra Nevada and figures that same thing out there. Here's the idea. It was called the geosynclinal concept, and it's one of the things that I first studied when I was in geology school in 1977 or 78. Did you do that as well? So, a long-standing concept. In the late 1890s, Edward Suess, I think is how you say it, he was Swiss, so I don't know if they're S-E-U-S-S, said something different there. His concept was that mountains were like the wrinkles that would form on a drying, shrinking apple. Best geologic hypothesis of the time is it's like wrinkles on a drying, shrinking apple. It's the best they had. That was his idea. People got that sort of into their head. Another thing that he thought was that due to these cooling pressures, there would be large areas of collapse on the planet. A number of people believe that this place that they saw as being the North Atlantic Ocean was really what was left after the old continent of Atlantis had collapsed. And Suess also, he was the first one to coin the term Gondwana land, which some people have heard of that have studied geology to any extent. And Gondwana land, that was based on the fossils that he saw over a large area, and that was called the Gondwana assemblage. And he found it initially in Africa and Madagascar and India, and then later found it in Australia and Antarctica, which we don't show here. And so his thought was, if at some point those all had to be connected, they all had to be the same land so that the same creatures could live on those. If they had always been separated, how do you get the same creatures in three or four different places exactly the same if they've been separated for all that time? So his idea, I think he had to be in on this Atlantis idea, and as well, he felt there was a large block of crust that had at one point connected Africa with India that was now down-dropped. Anything else that he was known about? That was about it. In 1910, an American, a guy by the name of Taylor, was the first one to have some thinking along this continental drift idea. His difficulty was looking at the mountains in China and looking at the Himalayas. Those are relatively recent phenomena in the geologic past. I don't know what the real age of them is, 25 or 30 million years ago. He had a hard time believing that the shrinking apple idea could raise mountains to such a great height so quickly. He didn't buy it. His idea was something along the line that the continents were sort of sliding off of the North Pole and heading towards the equator. The Earth is actually not perfectly round, it's a little bit flat in some spots, and he thought that somehow that had to be related to the fact its circumference at the equator is a little bit greater, like 15 or 20 miles, than it is pole. So he thought, okay, there's a difference in elevation there, everything's sliding towards the equator. Who knows? To us it doesn't make a lot of sense, but then again, what was it that he was fighting against was the contracting apple thing. So we get to 1912, and Alfred Wegener, he had certainly thought about this previously, and Alfred Wegener was not a geologist by trade, he was a meteorologist. As I was reading it, also he was the son of an evangelical minister. I don't know how that plays into this, maybe it doesn't at all. And the sense I get about the schooling in Germany was it was a lot more holistic and a lot more interdisciplinary. And so Wegener was a meteorologist and had some interest in geology and knew a little bit of paleontology, and also was known very much as an Arctic explorer. When you look at his obituary of the time, he died on his third trip to Greenland, leading an expedition there, and at some point held the world record for the longest march across the ice. So he died in 1930, and of course at that time plate tectonics was a goofy idea at best, so he was known as a meteorologist and known as an Arctic explorer. His first idea for this theory of continental drift came from matching up the coastlines of Africa and South America. And if you do that, there's a reasonably good fit to that. And if you can hold these two kind of together, Kentucky and North America, it's not that bad at all. And he wasn't the first person to have looked at this. Francis Bacon, back whenever that was, previous to that, had seen the same thing and wondered about it. So that was the trigger. The next thing that Wegener looked at was the same fossil assemblage. And if you think of it being in Africa and a little bit in South America and some of it here in India, he mushed those things back together and pulled India off of here and kind of tucked it back in down here, and it all seemed to line up pretty good to him. He thought, well, maybe I'm onto something here. He presented this first in 1912 at a talk at Holden Village. No, he didn't. Published a small document in 1912, and then in 1915 published a book called The Origin of Oceans and Continents. That about covered it. So that was published and a total of 6 editions, the last 2 published by his brother after he passed away in 1930. So, let's say 1932, 1934. So for 20 years, this book was in print. And people had access to it and could evaluate it. And that's kind of where the trouble started. The first thing he did was sort of say, I wouldn't be presenting this hypothesis if the current one made everybody happy, if we had any confidence in that. And one of the difficulties that he had was kind of on this second handout that you have. This is a cross-section of rocks in the European Alps, so that if you would imaginarily go into the Alps and cut them and move half of them out of the way and look into it, this is what you'd see. And if you try to follow one of these layers through the Alps, you know, pick whichever one you like, there's one that kind of turns around here and gets twisted up and comes back down, and who knows what happens there, and then it comes out here, and then there's a little bit more over. That, this to me, if and to Alfred Wegener, if you cut a drying, shrinking apple and look at the wrinkles don't get into each. The wrinkle is something like that. It's not like that, right? So his idea was this indicated to him infinitely bigger pressure and force than you would think of a shrinking apple. So he felt there had to be something else going on. The other thing was the discovery of radioactivity in 1900, plus or minus, and the idea that the understanding that that added a lot of heat to the Earth, that the old cooling calculations that had been used by Kelvin and had been passed down no longer really seemed to apply. So that this the basic premise of this cooling contracting Earth may have some trouble. His idea was that sometime in geologic history, back in the Paleozoic, 300 or 400 million years ago, that there was this big supercontinent that he called Pangaea, which is Greek for all land. And the rest of the world, and this thing existed somewhere on the globe, and the rest of the world was called Panthalassa, which means all water. And at some point in more recently than that, it started to break up and the continents had started to drift off and move to their current locations. I don't think he was the first person to use continental drift, the terminology. I think it was in people starting to talk about his theory, and then he cobbled it back into his book. So what, he's got this idea, it's certainly different. You better have some rationale behind it or you're going to get run out of town. First thing is, the current theory isn't any good, or isn't acceptable, or isn't satisfying. This principle of isostasy that had been one of the cornerstones of geologic thinking to the time indicated that there had to be a plastic layer in there that stuff was floating on. And everybody seemed cool with the idea that stuff could float up and down. Why can't it go sideways? What's so big about that? So he said, it should be possible. So my idea still works. The next couple of things were that coastline matching that he had done, and the matching of some rocks and also the fauna. And he said, wait a minute, you guys are talking about huge blocks, big bloody blocks of material being dropped down into the earth. I'm talking about continents scooting around. Which one of those is an odder idea? If you pull all this stuff back together the way I think it should be, all of these, this fauna that is now spread out all over the place, all kind of lives in the same place. One other thing that he noticed is what geologists call paleoclimatological evidence. And it is, the idea is, if the part of the world that you're in is extremely cold, you should find a certain kind of geologic units related to glaciers, since that's where glaciers form. And if you live near some swampy area and it's really hot, you should plan on finding coal there. So he pulled things back together, and there are things called tillites, which are made out of rock made out of glacial till, which is stuff that comes off of glaciers. And there's a little bit of it down here, and there's a big swath of it right here, and there's a little bit right here, and there's some over here. And he pulls everything back together and says, okay, here's where your glacier was, and this is the way it went, and explains things, and that's the distribution. Or else, what you need to do is explain, well, there's a little glacier here, and a big one right here, and another one right here, and another one here. He pulled everything back together, said it seemed to make sense to him. Unfortunately, he also came up with a couple of really harebrained ideas, and it opened him up to a lot of the argument that came to him. One of those was that he thought he could prove that Greenland was shooting away from Europe at an extremely high rate by bouncing radio signals from somewhere to Greenland and reflecting them back and then waiting some time and doing it again. And if it took longer for him to get back, then Greenland had moved. It's the process that we use now with lasers rather than radio waves. And he was right about the fact that Greenland's moving. It's just it's moving so slow that he could have done it in his entire life and never would have gotten any difference in that transit time. The other thing he thought he could do was matching another kind of glacial feature called a moraine between Europe and North America. So that when you pull things back together here and those two were connected and the glaciers came down, there were moraines that started in Europe, and since North America was right next to them, they went into the part that's now separated widely. Now, tracing glacial moraines is okay from here to the Stehekin Valley. You can kind of do you can correlate the times of those reasonably well. To try and do it over the scale that he was talking about of tens or hundreds of miles, not the thousands of miles that it is currently, was just really, you can't do it. And so by putting that into his list of arguments, that was one of the things that his detractors had a field day with. And if you present something based on six or eight different arguments, if people want to shoot you down, they can ignore all the good ones and focus on the bad ones and throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's very much what happened. That's a lot of the grief that he took was for simply that issue. They picked on his two bad ideas. They questioned some of his good points, and they turned out to be wrong about that. The idea that came out to sort of supersede Seuss's idea about these big blocks that had fallen down was that somehow there were these land bridges that were much smaller, but that sort of pulsed up and down in geologic time, and so that there would be little fingers of ground that would connect what's now Somalia with India and allow the critters to go back and forth, and that would solve the problem. It's not how it turned out, but it's an alternative to this idea of continental drift. The biggest geophysical argument was, how do you have rocks that are so strong that they can hold up continents, and yet you've got continents plowing through them? It just didn't seem to make sense. And the primary protagonist of that point of view was an American geophysicist, and he was sort of a tormentor of Wegener's all through, well, and even after he was dead. But it just seemed inconceivable to this guy, and he stuck to his point into the 60s when everybody else had sort of changed their mind. He still said, no, this can't happen, the crust is too strong. In 1927, there was a South African, Alex Du Toit, who sort of came in on Wegener's side because he was a South African, he had studied the rocks of South Africa. He had also been to South America and had studied those rocks and said, these rocks are exactly the same. I think this guy's onto something. And one of the things to sort of keep in mind here is the people who were pulling apart Wegener's ideas, the Europeans, particularly the British and particularly the Americans, had never been to South Africa or South America. So it's kind of easier to pull stuff apart. One of the neat things I think about geology is if we disagree about the geology, we can go walk and stand on it and have our fight there. It's not going any well. It's going places, but really slow. To me, it's one of the stories here of this whole acceptance of the theory is that people who were sort of farthest away from it had the most to say bad about it. If you're going to tear somebody's idea down, at least do them the favor of going looking and seeing the evidence. In 1930, Wegener died, and so there really wasn't anybody after that to sort of take up the cause. Dutoy didn't want to be this new champion, and he just went about his geological work. And the idea of continental drift sort of went to being this, some people like it, some people don't, to being completely laughed at, I guess. Well, I just want to read one bit that an American geologist wrote in 1943. I confess that my reason refuses to consider continental drift possible. This position is not assumed on impulse. It is one established by 20 years of study of the problem of former continental connections as presented by Wegener, Taylor, Suture, Dutoy, and others, with a definite purpose of giving due consideration to every hypothesis which may explain the proven facts. But when conclusive negative evidence regarding any hypothesis is available, that hypothesis should, in my judgment, be placed in the discard, since further discussion of it merely encumbers the literature and befogs the mind of fellow students. Fellow scientists who are not geologists cannot be expected to know that the geology upon which protagonists of the theory rest assumptions is as antiquated as pre-Curie physics, meaning physics before radioactivity. Wegener and his successors are disciples of Edward Suess, the master of European geologists. I knew him well, a charming, genial German who never traveled far, but assembled the observations of others and from them constructed speculations regarding the face of the earth. His reading was prodigious, his memory marvelous, his imagination grand, but he gravely lacked critical faculty. And when some airy concept had grown in his mind, it became too firmly rooted ever to be dislodged. Such a concept was Gondwanaland, the continent supposed to have extended from the East Indies westward to the Pacific, embracing India, Africa, and South America, and occupying the sites of the Indian and South Atlantic oceans. It had no actual existence. Thus, the theory of continental drift is a fairy tale. It is a fascinating fancy which has captured imaginations. Now, I think back in, like, Revolutionary War days, that was being called out for a duel, right? If you're going to say, today it's called talking smack, I guess. You got to have a little bit of confidence in yourself to write stuff like that, I think. One thing that maybe some of you have been thinking about that I've kind of been saving to point out till now is all of the conversation from 1912 to 1943 when Bailey Wills wrote that was based on a study of about 30% of the world, 70% of the world nobody had ever looked at the geology of because it was covered by water. So here we are from 1788 to 1943, however long that is into the science of geology, And we've only looked at 30% of the surface of the planet and made all these hypotheses about how the whole thing works. And I've been trying to think of some analogy to equate this to, like, you're a doctoral student and you can only dissect somebody's legs. Or all you can do is look at their skin. It covers 30% of the body. That's all you need to do, right? It's sort of inconceivable to write these grand ideas with looking at so little of the puzzle. So the next step here is to expand our horizons and see what the geology of other parts of the planet have to say. And this started primarily, the two areas of investigation were studies of rock magnetism and studies of the topography of the ocean basins. Now, I talked a little while ago about magnetism. The Earth generates its own magnetic field and it's surrounded by that magnetic field. We're not sure how it is generated, but that it exists. And what that leads is to... It's really hard to see these. This is the Earth, and it's really rounder than that. Lines of magnetic force exit the planet at about South Pole and come in at the North Pole. Right? And the way I think about this is it's the equivalent to having a huge magnet at the North Pole. Wherever you are and wherever your compass is, it points to the North Pole. What we find is that rocks with any magnetic material in them, that magnetic bit of the rock lines up with the North Pole. If it's an igneous rock, if it's a rock that has solidified from melted material, as it is solidifying, as those grains that have, or those crystals that have magnetic material in them start to solidify and cool, that magnetic material points north. For certain kinds of sedimentary rock, rocks that are made of material that gets washed out, like by a stream or into the ocean, particularly those ocean rocks, once they get out, the material gets outside any sort of wave action, those things are just floating down through the water. There's no other force on them, and they, in time, align to that North Pole. So rocks have the ability to get aligned to some specific direction, in this case, north. Magnetic studies started in the early 1900s, and they found a few different things. One was that any real current magma, any current lava, when you cut it out and looked at the did the analysis and looked at the things, pointed to the north. If you went back a little further in time, things either pointed straight north or straight south, and they kind of said, "Well, we don't get it, but let's leave that on the shelf for right now. We'll fight that one later." And then later, older magmas, when they did the magnetics on that, they found stuff pointing this way, and stuff pointing that way, and stuff pointing this way, and it made no sense at all. Because that would somehow indicate that the magnetic pole had been all over the place at different times. That sort of opened up the science of what's called paleomagnetism, paleo meaning old, or ancient, ancient magnetism. Through a long time and a fair amount of serious study, what they found was, let's talk about geology in Africa for a minute. If you took the magma the lava that was a certain age and found out that it really pointed to a North Pole, like right there, can people in the back see that? Is that good? And you go back a little further in time, and it seems like the North Pole's here. And you go back a little further in time, and it seems like the North Pole's here. And the next time the North Pole's here, and the next time the North Pole's here. And so you tie those together, and they had what's called a polar wander curve, which means that if Africa's been where it's always been. Somehow, the North Pole has been at those various places at various points in time. Which is another one of those things that you got to kind of go, we'll sort this out soon, but I don't understand it yet. And one of the ways that you can sort of be comfortable that maybe this was really true is, I mean, if the North Pole is right here, that means that Africa is kind of about where Greenland is now, right? If you find Attilite at that point, then you have reasonable confidence in your North Pole being right here and that your measurements are correct and things are the way you think they ought to be. If instead at that age, next to your lava, you've got coal beds, something's wrong because that coal bed indicates that you're down by the equator somewhere. So a lot of work went into these polar wander curves, and if you think about the options here, one of them is that if you do this for Africa, and if you do this for the United States, and if you do it for China, and all the curves turn out to match up with each other, then yeah, the North Pole's been all over the place. We don't know why that is, but at least it all seems to match. On the other hand, if you do one like this for Africa, and you do another one for America, and it shows that the North Pole has been over here, going something like this, now there's real problems. You got two North Poles. And you do another one for Australia, and it turns out different, and now you got three North Poles. Or something else is going on. And in fact, they did seven or eight and came up with seven or eight different polar wander curves. Now, what's going on? Let's leave that idea, let's leave that as confusion for right now. And go back to the earlier confusion we were talking about the magnetic reversals, right? Not really recent lavas, but a little bit older lavas that were pointing both either due north or due south. This was found primarily in, or the first place it was looked at was in Iceland, because there's so much lava coming out there so regularly that it's a good place to study things like that. And sure enough, you'd find a lava that was pointing due north, and then you'd find another lava that you figured was a little bit older and it's pointing due south. And the first lines that you try to do are say, okay, are my measurements wrong? So you go out and take them again and know they're right. Is there some other explanation? Is there something about mineralogy? Is there something about the geology that somehow these, if it cooled differently, would that make it reorient? So you go to the lab and you do a bunch of lab experiments and you can't get rocks that are north magnetic to all of a sudden become south magnetic, so that doesn't work. And then you go out and you talk to your buddies who are doing geology in Africa, and they find the same thing. Rocks of the same age all point north, and rocks of the same other age all point south. And you go, okay, it ain't just happening here in Iceland, it's happening in Africa too. Now we've got some global phenomenon that we can't sort out. And it kind of came to that place that all of the lavas that were less than a million years old, and they figured this out by radioactive dating that we talked about a little bit yesterday, all of the lavas that were less than a million year old were all due north. Those from about 2.5 million years old to the 1 million year old were all due south. No explanation. To this day, there is still no explanation for how that happens. There has to be some change in some whatever flow is going on in that liquid iron outer core. Something goes on down there. But for as important as those have become in the study of geology, there's still no idea as to how they got there and why it happens and what sort of difficulties might be encountered during one of these changes in magnetic pole. The other issue was this starting to look at the seabed and starting to look beneath the water and see what was there. And the first way that this was done was through echo sounding or seismic refraction. And we were out here a couple of years ago as part of the tailing study doing just that thing. When we were blowing up the explosives, was anybody here for that? That's what one of the few things anybody remembers about getting some more in here is we blew stuff up. And this kind of stuff actually happened, the first sort of depth sounding of the ocean bottom came into play 1942, 1943, 1944, 1945 in preparation for amphibious landings during the Second World War. And then as you move from the Second World War into the Cold War, it becomes important to know what the bottom looks like so that you can hide your submarines there when the other guys are looking for them. And the way that you do that is here's the water and here's your boat, and you trail something behind in the water that picks up sound. And particularly at the end of World War II, there was a lot of spare explosives laying around, and they would throw over the side and explode, and sound waves would come back and in time show up at their recorder. And from that, they could deduce a depth to the bottom. The first thing, or one of the first things that was found from doing that was that as you go back and forth across the ocean, right in the center of the ocean is a huge mountain range. It's taller than the Rockies and taller than the Sierra Nevadas and the Cascades, not quite as tall as the Himalayas. But nobody had a really good idea as to what it was doing there. It certainly wasn't, everybody thought that, you know, it was kind of flat and deep, but then you came up to the next continent and go on from there.
Don, it's about 2 minutes to seven, just to, you know.
Okay. let me talk for those 2 minutes about a little more stuff that's under the ocean, and we'll quit for tonight. They found a big mountain range running through the North Atlantic. They found another one running through the Pacific. Another thing that they found were very deep trenches lying offshore from South America. This part of North America, the Aleutian Islands, Japan, down through Taiwan and the Philippines, and through Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. So they found some mountains that they didn't think they'd find, and they found some trenches that they didn't think they'd find. Two other things. When they got to looking at the rocks that are beneath the ocean, it's all about the same thing. It's all about the same kind of rock. And it's different because on the continents you got all different kinds of rocks. To find a very consistent rock type and to have it be generally different, it's called basalt. We have a lot of it in Oregon. We have a lot of it in India, and that's about the only places there's a lot of it, except underneath 70% of the planet. And the other thing that they found was they couldn't find any rocks that were older than 160 million years. Oldest continental rocks go back to 3.6 billion years. And from 3.6 billion years to today, you can go back and you can find rocks in pretty much every one of those ages. You go out to the offshore and you go look anywhere you can on the ocean bottom, and the oldest rocks they could find were 160 million years old. And so with those questions to get you to come back tomorrow, I'll stop for tonight. Tomorrow's talk is at 3:45. We'll pick up here and finish the rest of the detective story and then go into why plate tectonics explains earthquakes and volcanoes and the San Andreas Fault and why we find things where we do. And I'll be glad to take questions after the staff meeting up in the dining hall there with ice cream.